was that that cried out?" The second soldier says, "The prophet, princess." "Ah, the prophet, he of whom the tetrarch is afraid?" "We know nothing of that, princess. It was the prophet Yochanan who cried out." Naboth says, he's very unhappy that she's there and he wants to get rid of her. At this point, "Is it your pleasure that I bid them to bring your litter, princess? The night is fair over in the garden." Yes, he does not want Herod to know that she's been hanging out by Yochanan. And Salome ignores him. "He says terrible things about my mother, does he not?" Let's listen to Salome's entrance. Yes, indeed, Salome will not be distracted. She is intrigued by the voice coming from the cistern. She finds out that John is a young man. Naboth is beside himself, but his feelings for Salome betray him. She convinces Naboth to bring John out from the cistern. "You will do this thing for me, Naboth. You know that you will do this thing for me. And tomorrow I will look at you through the muslin veils, Naboth. I will look at you. It may be I will smile at you. Look at me, Naboth. Look at me. Ah, you know that you will do this thing I ask of you. You know it well. I know that you will do this thing." Yes, this is no naive child, my friends. She is fully aware of her power over men, and she knows how to use it. The prophet comes out of the cistern. Salome looks at him and steps slowly back. John says, "Where is he whose cup of abominations is now full? Where is he who in a robe of silver shall one day die in the face of all the people?" Yeah, he's asking, where is Herod Antipas? "Bid him come forth, that he may hear the voice of him who hath cried in the waste places and in the houses of kings." Now, please note, when we hear John speak, we hear magnificent, almost heroic music. John's music is straightforward and lacking in the kind of melodic and harmonic complexity we just heard from Salome. Strauss has made John a man beyond the other men in this opera. John's entrance. John proceeds to begin railing against Herodias, that is, Salome's mother. And Salome at first asks, is he talking about my mother? And ultimately she realizes that he is. And he continues to rail against Herodias. Salome is both repulsed and increasingly fascinated by John. She's never seen or heard anything quite like this before. She says, it is his eyes above all that are terrible. They are like black caverns where dragons dwell. They are like black lakes troubled by a fantastic moon. Do you think he will speak again? How wasted he is! He's like a thin ivory statue. I'm sure he is chaste as the moon is. His flesh must be cool like ivory. I would look closer at him. Now, John, of course, is disgusted with Salome's licentious attention. Back, daughter of Babylon, come not near the chosen of the Lord. But she will not be put off. Speak again, Yochanan. Thy voice is like sweet music to my ears. Now, is she teasing this poor man? Or is she serious? We're not sure yet. Speak again, Yochanan, and tell me what I must do. Daughter of Sodom, come not near me, but cover thy face with a veil and scatter ashes upon thine head and get thee to the desert and seek out the Son of Man. Who is he, the Son of Man? Is he as beautiful as thou art, Yochanan? O Yochanan, I am amorous of thy body. Thy body is white like the lilies of a field that the mower hath never mowed. Thy body is white like the snows that lie on the mountains of Judea. There is nothing in the world so white as thy body. Let me touch thy body. Woe, she would seem to be serious. And please, I would point out that I'm not reading chronologically. I'm just reading certain lines. You can read the entire libretto at your leisure. John responds, back, daughter of Babylon. By woman came evil into this world. Speak not to me. I will not listen to thee. I listen but to the voice of the Lord God. John rejects Salome outright, something our young, spoiled, and sexually uninhibited princess is not accustomed to. She gets a bit angry. Thy body is hideous. It's like the body of a leper. She's repelled and attracted at the same time. It is of thy hair that I am enamored, Yochanan. Let me touch thy hair. Back, daughter of Sodom, touch me not. Profane not the temple of the Lord God. Well, thy hair is horrible. It's covered with mire and dust. It is thy mouth that I desire, Yochanan. There is nothing in the world so red as thy mouth. Let me kiss thy mouth. Never! Daughter of Babylon, daughter of Sodom, never! I will kiss thy mouth, Yochanan. I will kiss thy mouth. Yes, indeed, my friends, she will. Salome's teasing has turned to infatuation, and her infatuation will soon turn to obsession. Now, both these words and the complex music Strauss wrote in setting them caused big problems for the original cast. Strauss himself writes, at the very first piano read-through, the singers assembled in order to give back their parts to the conductor, all except the Herod, a Czech singer named Burian, who, when asked last of all, said, well, I already know my part by heart. Bravo, I said. At this, the others felt ashamed, and the work of the rehearsal actually started. During the casting rehearsals, the dramatic soprano, Frau Wittisch, went on strike. She had been entrusted with the part of the 16-year-old princess with the voice of Isolde, on account of the strenuousness of the part and the thickness of my orchestration. One just doesn't write like that, Herr Strauss, either one thing or the other. With much to-ing and much fro-ing, she protested angrily like any Saxon burgomaster's wife. I won't do it. I'm a decent woman, I am. Well, whether or not she wanted to, she did do it. Back to the story. Herod, completely enamored of his stepdaughter Salome, eventually leaves the banquet and follows her out onto the terrace. He has been drinking a lot. Dance for me, Salome. I have no desire to dance, Tetrarch. Salome, daughter of Herodias, dance for me. I will not dance, Tetrarch. Salome, Salome, dance for me. I pray thee, dance for me. I am sad tonight. Therefore, dance for me, Salome, dance for me. If you dance for me, You may ask of me what you will, and I will give it to you. Oh, my goodness, a mistake, a big mistake. Herod has not a clue what he just saith. Salome, rising, will you indeed give me whatsoever I shall ask, Tetrarch? And while she says this, a bird-like flute, very seductive, accompanies her lines. Everything, whatsoever you desire, I will give it to you, even to half of my kingdom. You swear it, Tetrarch? I swear it, Salome. By what will you swear, Tetrarch? By my life, by my crown, by my gods, even to the half of my kingdom. I will dance for you. Salome brings perfumes and the seven veils and takes off her sandals. Voice of John. Who is this who cometh from Edom? Who is this who cometh from Bozra, whose raiment is dyed with purple, who shineth in the beauty of his garments, who walketh mighty in his greatness? Wherefore is thy raiment stained with scarlet? And Herodias, the wife of Herod, the mother of Salome, responds, Let us go within. The voice of that man maddens me. I will not have my daughter dance while he is continually crying out. I will not have her dance while you look at her in this fashion. In a word, I will not have her dance. Herod says, Do not rise, my wife, my queen. It will avail thee nothing. I will not go within till she hath danced. Dance, Salome, dance for me. Herodias says, Do not dance, my daughter. But Salome says, I am ready, Tetrarch. And Salome dances the dance of the seven veils. Let's listen to this scene and the very beginning of the dance of the seven veils. price for the dance? Herod should have gotten this up front. He might have done without the dance, thank you very much. The price, of course, is the head of John the Baptist. Aye! Yells Herod. Herod is terrified. To kill a prophet? Unspeakable. Impossible. But he has sworn, and he's sworn to the object of his desire. Eventually, agonizingly, he gives in to her demand and orders John's execution. I read from the libretto, A huge black arm, the arm of the executioner, comes forth from the cistern, bearing on a silver shield the head of Yochanan. Salome seizes the head. Ah, thou wouldst not suffer me to kiss thy mouth, Yochanan. Well, I will kiss it now. I will bite it with my teeth as one bites a ripe fruit. Yes, I will kiss thy mouth, Yochanan. I said it. Did I not say it? Yes, I said it. Ah, I will kiss it now. But wherefore dost thou not look at me, Yochanan? Thine eyes that were so terrible, so filled with rage and scorn, are shut now. Wherefore are they shut? Open thine eyes. Lift up thine eyelids, Yochanan. Well, thou hast seen thy God, Yochanan, but me, thou didst never see. If thou hadst seen me, thou wouldst have loved me. I am thirsty for thy beauty. I am hungry for thy body. Neither wine nor fruits can appease my desire. What shall I do now, Yochanan? Neither the floods nor the great waters can quench my passion. Oh, wherefore didst thou not look at me, Yochanan? If thou hadst looked at me, thou wouldst have loved me. Well, I know thou wouldst have loved me. Oh, my goodness. She goes on and on and on. Her sexual obsession with John has now become something near to madness. Conclusion. Herod is stunned, horrified, repulsed by what he sees. He says, Sie ist ein Ungeheuer, deine Tochter. Ich sage dir, sie ist ein Ungeheuer. She is a monster, your daughter. I tell you, she is a monster. Herodias says, I approve of what my daughter has done, and I will stay here now. Herod, ah, there speaks the incestuous wife. Come, I will not stay here. Come, I tell thee, surely some terrible thing will befall. And indeed, the night darkens. Salome continues to make out with the mouth. Ah, I have the head. Ah, I have kissed thy mouth, Yochanan. Ah, I have kissed thy mouth. There was a bitter taste on thy lips. Was it the taste of blood? No, but perchance it is the taste of love. They say that love hath a bitter taste. But what of that? What of that? I have kissed thy mouth, Yochanan. I have kissed thy mouth. Now, this phrase is at first delivered in a monotone. Salome is completely demented. Her lips are covered with John's blood. However, as she evokes the taste of love, the music builds to a shattering, ecstatic, absolutely orgasmic climax. And we'll hear an incredible dissonance at that moment. It is at this moment, with Salome embracing John's head and quivering and shaking with ecstasy, that a moonbeam falls on her and illuminates what she's doing. Herod turns around and sees Salome and sees all that I've just described, and he shouts, "Kill that woman!" The soldiers rush forth and crush beneath their shields Salome, daughter of Herodias, princess of Judea. Please, from Sie ist ein Ungeheuer, she is a monster.
Sie ist ein Ungeheuer, deine Tochter. Ich sage dir, sie ist ein Ungeheuer.
Meine Tochter hat er nicht. Ich möchte empfehlen, meine Tochter. Das mit meinem Bruders Leib.
Komm, ich will nicht an diesem Ort bleiben.
Komm, sag ich dir.
Sicher, es wird Schreckliches geschehen. Wir wollen uns im Palast bewegen, Herodias. Ich fange an zu zittern.
Thank you.
Thus ends the opera. Some conclusions, please. Opera historian and psychiatrist Eric Plaut writes, Salome is a textbook of psychopathology. Maraboth suffers from an atypical impulse control disorder. Herod has phobias in addition to his voyeurism. Herodias is an antisocial personality. Salome starts out as a narcissistic personality, moves to a fetishistic obsession with Yohanan's body, and ends up a psychotic necrophiliac. Everyone is suffused with perverse sexuality. Even Yohanan is obsessed with it. The subject fascinated the creative world at the turn of the century. Kraft Ebing had published his Psychopathia Sexualis in 1886, and Freud and Breuer their studies on hysteria in 1893. The revolt against 19th century puritanical attitude toward sexuality was in full bloom. Within 2 years of its premiere in 1905, Salome had been produced in over 50 cities. Some believed the opera nothing but pornography. Others found it artistically seditious, and in doing so, they agreed with Plato. Plato, who wrote that, quote, a change to a new type of music is something to beware of as a hazard of all our fortunes, for the modes of music are never disturbed without unsettling the most fundamental political and social conventions. So wrote Plato, who knew well the power of music. First and foremost, Salome is an opera of its time, one considered by many the first great opera of the 20th century. We save our final words for Richard Strauss himself. Quote, one can consider Salome a unique experiment with particular material, but not one recommended for imitation, unquote. Not that anyone would or could. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 29, the first of a two-lecture set entitled simply, Russian Opera. A characteristically Russian language operatic style developed even later than did German opera. Indeed, a genuine Russian national school of any sort of musical composition did not appear until the 1830s. The rise of a distinctly Russian music had much to do with 19th century nationalism. So please, my friends, a quick diversion to and discussion of the nature of 19th century musical nationalism and the very special nature of 19th century Russian musical nationalism. The French Revolution of 1789 became a highly exportable model in an increasingly educated, enlightened, and middle-class Europe. 1848 has come to be known as the year of failed revolutions. That year, insurrections broke out almost spontaneously in Bohemia, specifically in Prague, in Hungary, specifically in Budapest, in Austria, in Vienna, and as well in Italy, Norway, Poland, and as usual, in Paris. Please, I would remind you that the French Revolution, the first French Revolution, took place between 1789 and 95. But I would also remind you that with the defeat of Napoleon, the Bourbon family, that is, Louis XVIII, was instated, or should we say reinstated, to the throne in 1815. We call this the Bourbon Restoration. And so it would seem, after this 26 years of revolution and Napoleonic era, that we're right back to where we were in 1789 in France in 1815. Instead of Louis XVI, we got Louis XVIII. Louis XVII died in jail in that interim period. So we have a series of other revolutionary insurrections in France, specifically in Paris. We have one in 1830. We have one in 1848. We have one in 1870. With all due respect, and without seeming too cute, might I suggest that what baseball became in the United States, so revolutions became in France, particularly in Paris. the national pastime, my friends. Get your red huts. Get your souffle. Get your guillotines. Get your programs. You cannot tell the radical faction without your programs. Now, back to rather more serious things, thank you. These failed revolutions of 1848, for reasons too complex and too lengthy, I'm not going to get into the reasons why they failed. Suffice it to say that fail they did, one after the other. Artistic nationalism replaced outlawed political activism as a mode by which national identity and fervor could be expressed. In particular, the year of failed revolutions, that is, 1848, gave rise to a musical movement known as nationalism. The characteristic feature of this movement was the incorporation of national folk music, or folk-like melodies, into concert works, songs, and operas. Tone poems and operas were based on programs and libretti that they themselves were based on national themes, legends, and myths. The result of all of this, my friends, was opera and concert music that stirred strong emotions at home and made a powerful ethnic impression abroad. For example, in Bohemia, that would be the Czech Republic today, a Czech language national opera developed during the second half of the 19th century, to a great degree in direct response to the failed revolution of 1848. For example, we see the operas of Bedřich Smetana, The Bartered Bride of 1866, Dalibor of 1868, The Kiss of 1876. We see Anton Dvorak's wonderful opera, Ruzalka. Oh, I'm going to get on my soapbox for just a moment. There are certain composers who we know from their instrumental music, and there are certain composers we know from their operas. But often, a composer who wrote both is only known for one or the other. And Dvorak is a perfect example of a wonderful opera composer who's known for his chamber music and symphonies, but not so much for the operatic output. And I would, at this moment, just stand here and promote to any promoter who might be watching, Rusalka. It's a wonderful opera, and it dates from 1901. Leos Janáček wrote Janufa and The Cunning Little Vixen in 1824. So I would point out that Czech opera is, to a great degree, the result of the spirit of individuality and national fervor that was created by the Enlightenment and stirred by the French Revolution and the failed revolutions of 1848. Music as a mirror, an entire school of national opera that is a response to political and environmental issues. All right, now, Russian musical nationalism specifically. Russian musical nationalism is less a reaction to the events of 1848 and more a reaction to Russia's entry into the European world and the desire, oh, always the desire on the part of Russian artists to ensure the preservation of their unique musical heritage in the face of encroaching Italian and German musical dominance. Yes, my friends, the Russian fear of outsiders would be a constant in Russian history, and Russian musical nationalism is to a great degree the result of Russian musical fear of outside dominance. Xenophobia as a compositional inspiration only in Russia. All right, a little background, please. Peter I is the first Russian Tsar to attempt to lift Russia out of the Middle Ages, and Peter lived in what we would call in Western Europe during the Baroque era, between 1682 and 1725. Peter builds another Venice, and that's what he wanted it to be, and that's frankly what it looks like, at the mouth of the Neva River. It becomes his window on the West, this new Venice, and he stocks this new city with the best foreign artists, musicians, and teachers his money can buy. St. Petersburg, named for his patron saint, becomes the most westernized and culturally diverse city in all of Russia. One reason for this is that in St. Petersburg, it is the aristocratic class. It's the court that holds sway, not the Russian Orthodox Church, a notoriously conservative and medieval organization. Until the 19th century, cultivated music in St. Petersburg, which means basically cultivated music in Russia, as most of the Western European musical culture you would have heard in Russia at that time, you would have heard in St. Petersburg. So until the 19th century, cultivated music at St. Pete consisted of the following: Italian opera, seria, buffa, and bel canto; two, light Viennese and Italian instrumental music; and three, aristocratic amateur concerts. Russia truly emerged and became part of the greater European community as a result of two galvanizing historical events. First, the defeat of Napoleon in 1812, and the Decembrist Revolt. Decembrist Revolt, which occurred in December of 1825. This was a failed attempt to create a constitutional monarchy based on the ideals of the French Revolution. The spirit of individual freedom and nationalism that powered this Decembrist revolution was felt throughout the intellectual and artistic classes of Russia. In and around the year 1825, there was a conscious decision made by certain Russian writers, poets, and musicians, a conscious decision to cultivate a uniquely Russian language artistic tradition, as opposed to Italian opera seria, buffa, and bel canto, as opposed to the light Viennese and Italian instrumental music played by amateurs and professionals alike, to cultivate a uniquely Russian language artistic tradition. And all of this is occurring around the year 1825. Preeminent among these Russian nationalists was the poet and author Alexander Sergeyevich Pushkin, who lived from 1799 to 1837. Now, though he was born into a noble family, Pushkin was a kind of Lord Byron-inspired, individualistic, nationalistic rabble-rouser, one of them hippy-dippy left-wing agitator types, if you'll excuse me. Pushkin did for the Russian language what Goethe did for the German language. Through the model of his own works, he provided a literary heritage for a Russian language which, up to his time, had been considered unfit for fine literature. Among Pushkin's works turned into operas were Eugene Onegin and Queen of Spades. Both of these were turned into operas by Peter Tchaikovsky. Boris Godunov turned into an opera by Modest Mussorgsky. And Ruslan and Ludmilla turned into an opera by Mikhail Glinka. So let us move on, please, to Mr. Glinka, the godfather of Russian music. Mikhail Ivanovich Glinka, 1804 to 1857. The history of a true Russian music and Russian opera begins with Mikhail Glinka. Born into a wealthy land-owning family, Glinka's early musical education consisted of the usual piano and violin lessons. Yes, this would be typical for someone of his class, a certain degree of cursory polish given him in Western artistic tradition. In 1824, at the age of 20, Glinka became a civil servant, working in the Ministry of Ways and Communication in St. Petersburg. Now, this should not come as a surprise to us that someone who is gifted in music gets a job as a civil servant. Please, educated young Russian men from the upper classes typically entered either the civil service or the military for a career. I would point out that real Russian men were not professional musicians. Yes, Italians were musicians. Perhaps even Germans were musicians, but not Russians, not professionals. 2 points. First of all, it wasn't considered a properly masculine thing to do. There's no macho in being a professional musician. And might I editorialize for a moment? This is an attitude we see also in the United States, really up to the mid-20th century. Foreigners are professional musicians. Real men have real jobs, make real money, and do real things. Music, oh, is for the ladies and the foreigners. And that attitude permeates Russian culture as well as it did permeate American culture. Point two, musicians in Russia had no acknowledged
social status in the mid-19th century. In 1862, Anton Rubinstein, the great Russian pianist and founder of the St. Petersburg Conservatory, wrote this, and I quote, "Russia has almost no artist musicians in the exact sense of this term. This is because our government has not given the same privileges to the art of music that are enjoyed by the other arts, such as painting, sculpture, etc. That is, he who practices music is not given the official rank of an artist." So it's a kind of artistic black hole, the world of music in mid and early 19th century Russia. We move on to 1834. Inspired by Pushkin and Nikolai Gogol, Glinka decides to compose an opera on a Russian subject, but more importantly, in the Russian language. The result was the opera, A Life for the Tsar, premiered in the presence of the imperial family on December 9 of 1836. A Life for the Tsar was a triumph, a gigantic success. Now please, melodically and rhythmically, A Life for the Tsar owes as much to Italy as it does to Russia. And it employs as well the large choruses and the dance episodes of French opera. But it is written in the Russian language. And in it, Glinka devised a flexible and highly melodic style of recitative that well complements the rhythms and the inflections of the Russian language. And if we have heard the sound of the Russian language, we know how completely different it is from any of the Western European languages, whether they be Germanic or Romance languages. So a music well accommodated to the rhythm and inflection of Russian will naturally sound different than a music accommodated to the rhythms and inflections of French, Italian, or German. Russian national music begins with A Life for the Tsar in 1836. We can actually put a date on the beginning of Russian nationalism and a Russian national school. Now, Peter Tchaikovsky, writing many years later, was stunned by Glinka's transformation from musical amateur to, and I say this in quotations, genius. I quote Tchaikovsky, "A dilettante who played now on the violin, now on the piano, who composed colorless quadrilles and fantasies on stylish themes, who composed nothing but banalities in the taste of the 1830s, who suddenly, in the 34th year of his life, produces an opera which by its genius, breadth, originality, and flawless technique stands on a level with the greatest and most profound music? Incredible." Unquote. Let us move on to a more important opera in the output of Glinka, and that would be the opera Ruslan and Ludmilla of 1842. Please, gestation and content. Ruslan and Ludmilla is generally considered Glinka's great masterwork. The story is by Pushkin. Glinka had hoped dearly that Pushkin would write the libretto, and they had discussed Pushkin's writing of the libretto, though these hopes were dashed when Pushkin got himself killed in a duel in 1837. Instead, Glinka himself wrote the libretto along with someone named Valerian Shurkov. And I would tell you that four other librettists participated in adding certain sections of this opera to the larger libretto created by Glinka and Shurkov. Look, this creates a terrific mess. If you want to know the truth, the libretto ain't a pretty thing, and it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. Look, be that as it may, it's Glinka's music that's important. Glinka's score is filled with the sort of folk-inspired melodies, orientalisms, rhythmic irregularities, and orchestral effects that we have since come to associate as being Russian in character. My friends, Glinka's music, oh, is like the name brand that becomes a generic designation due to its universal usage. Kleenex and Jell-O, Xerox and Thermos, for example. These are all words that we use as designations, even though they were originally name brands. Well, the sound of Glinka's music is what we now call the Russian sound, simply due to its quality and the association of this music with the beginnings of a Russian school. Ruslan and Ludmilla, the story and the music. All right, Ruslan and Ludmilla opens with a brilliant and rollicking overture, and I'm going to play you the first couple minutes of it in just a moment. Here are the questions I want you to ask yourselves while listening. Does this music sound like bel canto Italian opera? Ding, 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 ding. Does this music sound like upright and magnificent French music? Ya-bam, ba-bam, ba-bam. Does this music sound like direct and serious German music? Well, does it? Overture, Ruslan and Ludmilla. Well, does this sound like bel canto opera? Does this sound like French opera? Does this sound like the serious German opera? Oh, no. No, this music is filled with the wild and, to Western ears, exotic sound of Russian dance. Fabulous rhythmicality, great energy, a very different sounding kind of music. And believe me, start an opera this way, you're going to have to continue the opera this way. All right, the story in a nutshell, it is a fairy tale, a folk yarn. The opera opens with a celebration held by the Grand Duke of Kiev, Sviatoslav, in honor of his daughter Ludmilla's three suitors. A bard prophesies a wondrous future if Ludmilla chooses Ruslan. Ludmilla herself welcomes her three suitors, and she sings of her reluctance to leave home and the joy that she has known there. Of her three suitors, Ruslan, a knight, Ratmir, an Oriental prince, and Farlov, a blustering coward, Ruslan is the favored one, and this should not come as a big surprise, given the title and all. Out of nowhere, a terrifying thunderclap is followed by sudden darkness across the stage. When order is restored, it is discovered that Ludmilla has disappeared, pop and zam. As we find out later, she did not head off to 7-Eleven for a quick Slurpee. Rather, she has been abducted by the evil dwarf, Chernomor. Ludmilla's father, Sviatoslav, promises her hand in marriage to the one who rescues her. And so, the action of the opera is initiated. What we're going to do with this opera is talk about some of the Glinka Russianisms that so fill the score. We don't have time to go through this opera in detail, and we wouldn't anyway. It's not an opera you'll generally see or hear in performance today, at least not outside of Russia. But it's an opera that's incredibly influential on the next generation of Russian composers, and those composers include such important opera composers as Mussorgsky and Rimsky-Korsakov. So let's observe some of the Russianisms that we hear across this score, so we have an idea what was so influential and so galvanizing to the Russian community in the 19th century. Immediately before the fateful thunderclap, we hear an ecstatic chorus which celebrates the wonder and the mystery of love. So we're back in Act 1, and let me read you this chorus. It's very wordy, but that's all right.
We have nowhere else to go right now. And then let's talk about the setting, because it's very different from anything we've heard up to this point in this course. Chorus. O mysterious, wonderful God of love. And that opening line becomes a refrain that keeps coming back and back and back across the span of these words. You pour ecstasy into our hearts. We glorify your power and strength, which cannot be avoided on earth. Refrain, O God of love, God of love. You transform our sad world into a heaven of happiness and pleasure. In the depths of night, through disasters and fear, you lead us to a bed of luxury. You fill our souls with passion, and you send a smile to our lips. O God of love, God of love. But, miraculous God of love, you are also the God of jealousy, who pours the fever of revenge into us. And on his bed of languor, you betray the unarmed criminal to his enemy. Thus, you even out sorrow and joy, so that we do not forget the gods. Refrain, O God of love, all that is great, all that is criminal, mortals learn from you. You lead us into the terrible battle to protect our land, as if leading us to a wondrous feast. You place a garland of laurels on the brows of the survivors, and you prepare a wake for those who fell in the battle for the fatherland. O mysterious, wonderful God of love, you pour ecstasy into our hearts. Now, I would point out what might be obvious, and of course, if you know this opera, it's very obvious. This chorus basically predicts all the action that's going to take place in the following opera, talking about jealousy and revenge and battle and so forth. It basically outlines the action to come. It's subtle, but it's there. Then, immediately after the chorus ends, we hear a short but loud thunderclap, and the stage darkens. And this is the moment when poor Ludmilla is abducted. All right, now, please, the Russianisms that we hear in this selection, in this chorus. Number one, please notice the engaging, clearly Slavic-sounding melody. From a folk point of view, this is not a folk song, but it's a folk-like melody. Glinka is speaking with the inflections of a Russian composer. Secondly, joyful, energized, and asymmetrical dance rhythms. Now, after we've heard this selection, I'm going to talk about what I mean by asymmetrical dance rhythms and the asymmetrical rhythms that are familiar in Russian music. Three, we hear a chant-like opening, a Gregorian chant-like opening, which sees the orchestra and the voices all singing and playing in unison, all the same pitches. It sounds very primal, and it sounds purposefully artless. I didn't say crude, but I said artless. That is, it sounds like something that has been composed to sound folk-like, the spontaneous singing of a happy group of people. Fourthly, note the syllabic setting. Russian, like German, is not a language given to long melismas. It's a language with very complex consonants. And as a result, a proper Russian setting is syllabic, not filled with curlicues and melismas like we would hear in Italian music, and even to a lesser degree in French music. Let us listen then to the chorus, O mysterious, wonderful God of love. And when we finish, we must talk about the special nature of Russian articulation and rhythm.
Yeah.
And there was our thunderclap, and the stage becomes dark. Now look, I said we have to talk a little bit about the different nature of Russian rhythm in Russian folk music, and indeed in Russian language, to understand what makes this music different rhythmically. When we talk about Western European folk music, and now I'm including the folk music of both Romance countries like Spain and Italy and France and German folk music, we have a folk music that is usually in what we call either duple or triple meter. That is, the beats are grouped by either twos or threes. For example, a perfect example of triple meter is a waltz, where we hear beats grouped by threes. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, and so forth. And once that meter is established in a waltz, it will continue throughout the piece. Likewise, something in duple meter means that we hear the beats grouped in twos or fours. For example, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one. And again, typical in Western folk music and Western concert music, once a duple meter is established, it will generally be maintained for the entire breadth of the movement, or at least that particular aria, if this is an opera. Now, Eastern European and Russian folk music is different. We have a language that's different. We have an asymmetrically accented language in Russian, for example. And so we don't have these nice, clean one, two, three, one, two, three. We have asymmetrical groupings. One, two, three, one, two, one, two, one, one, two, three, one, two, one, two, one, two, three, with accents falling all over the place. A group of two, a group of three, one, a group of three, a group of two, because this is a music that's well molded to a very special series of articulations. This is how Russian folk music, and I would also point out Bulgarian and Hungarian folk music, work. We have a music that's a reflection of a language, and it's a language that is asymmetrically accented, so we don't have the consistent meters we hear in the West. Now, in this particular piece, we had a grouping of five. This is called additive meter, where we have unequal groupings. A 3 plus a 2 equals a 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. And if you rewind your tapes and listen to this chorus again, you'll be able to count to 5. Not 4, not 3. You will not find groupings of 5 in Mozart, Handel, Beethoven, in the music of France, in the music of Italy. It's just not done in the 18th and the 19th century. It's just not done, but it's done in Russian music. And that's something that we hear. We might not notice it consciously, but it's something we hear, this rhythmic irregularity, this wonderful exotic approach to accentuation of differing groups of beats that sounds exotic and different, and we have come to label it Russian, or at least Slavic. And that's an important aspect of this music. And it's something that would not have been done by a Russian composer before Glinka. Glinka basically says, it's fine to do this. It's natural to do this. I'm going to do it. And by his model, the whole sound, the whole rhythmic nature of Russian music changes as Russians accept the patterns implicit to their own spirit, but patterns that they have not used because they'd rather copy Western European models. Point gotten? Point gotten. Let's continue. Farlov's Rondo. Of the three suitors, Farlov is clearly the third choice. Frankly, my friends, better a monastery than the toad Farlov. He's a braggart and a coward posing as a warrior. Farlov runs with bad company, and this includes a witch named Nena. Nena promises to deliver Ludmilla to Farlov, while Farlov basically sits at home in his castle in his recliner. Farlov, overjoyed at the prospect of such an easy victory, sings his famous rondo. Now, we've encountered that word rondo before in this chorus. When we listened to Mozart's Non più andrai from The Marriage of Figaro, I pointed out that it was a rondo. That means there was a refrain, and the refrain kept coming back after various other verses. So, this is a rondo, and here's the refrain. Farlov.
The hour of my triumph approaches. My hated rival will go far away from us. O knight, you are wasting your time in search of the princess. The witch's power will not let you get to her. And we'll keep hearing those words and the music associated with them, interspersed between these next verses. Ludmilla, your tears and groans are a waste of time, and you wait for your dear one in vain. Neither howls nor tears will do any good. Submit to Nena's power, princess. Ruslan, forget about Ludmilla. Ludmilla, forget about Ruslan. At the very thought of possessing the princess, my heart leaps with happiness, and I'm already beginning to feel the sweetness of revenge and love. In travail, in anguish, annoyance, and sadness, wander the world, my brave rival. Fight enemies, storm fortresses, without working or worrying, sitting in the castle of my forefathers, awaiting the commands of Nena, the desired day approaches, the day of ecstasy and love. And then we hear a reprise of three earlier heard verses, and this rondo ends. Now, note please the following. Farlov is a bass, and this aria demonstrates, well, the Russian preference for deep male voices, baritones, and basses. Now, Farlov's aria combines an opera buffa-like patter with a distinctly Russian style of melody. Its melodic patterns are, of course, a reflection of the Russian language in which it is sung. That's the big reason why the melody sounds Russian, because of the natural declamatory rhythms of the Russian language. So let's listen to this marvelous aria, a combination of Italian opera buffa style patter and the rhythms and contours of Russian rhythm and Slavic melody. Белого сердца напрасно дождет. Ни вопли, ни слезы, ничто не поможет. Смириться при власти, но и не кирда. Лица участка без мамы, ему ненавистный соперник уйдет. Но ребенок видит напрасно, ты тысяча. До нее не допустим, волшебница на тебя. Руслан зовут твой Людмиле. Людмила, жениха зовут. Предмысленно обладать нежной. Сердце радость ощущает, и затрах не внушает сладость вести и любви. Сердце радость ощущает, и затрах не внушает сладость вести и любви. Близок участка без мамы, его ненавистный соперник уйдет на него, там видит обратно, ты ищи, как он на нее не допустит, волшебница на себя. Работа, тревоги, досады и грусти. Скидайся по свету, мой храбрый соперник. Вместе с врагами в лесу и на твердыне, не трудясь и не заботясь, о намерении достигнуть замкнета, поджидая повеление наивы. Недалек же долгий день, день восторга и любви. Людмила, напрасно ты плачешь и стонешь, и милого сердца напрасно ты ждешь. Ни вопли, ни слезы, ничто не поможет, смириться при власти, но и не к тебе. Близок участок, и мама его ненавистна, соперник уйдет далеко, там видит напрасно ты ищет ее. На нее не допустит волшебница, воспитать заботы, тревоги, досады и грусти. Кидайся по свету, мой правый соперник, весь в ногами бежал на твердыне. Тревоги, досады и грусти, кидайся по свету, мой правый соперник, весь в ногами бежал на твердыне. Даже не заботится в намерении, на тех, кто как немедленно подлетает помиление на вере. Помиление, One is reminded of Dr. Bartolo's aria, Un dottor della mia sorte, from Rossini's Barber of Seville. Here we have basically a criminal element, a bad guy, but a basso singing in such a comic patter that it's hard for us to take him really seriously as a
Oh, just as an evil person. He's more a comic cutout than anything else. All right. Ruslan himself is also a deep-voiced male, not the tenor we would expect in Italian opera, but rather a bass baritone, that is, a male with a low voice that's used in the lowest end of his register. When Ruslan finally finds his beloved Ludmilla, she has been accursed. She's in a deep coma-like sleep and cannot be awakened. Ruslan's grief and frustration are well expressed in the following aria. Oh, love of my life, young wife. He's jumping the gun a little there, but okay. Can you really not hear me, the groans of your beloved? But her heart beats and flutters, and a smile plays on her beautiful lips. An unknown fear torments my soul. Oh, friends, who knows whether her smile is for me, whether the heart beats for me? Note, please, the plaintive, lonely clarinet, which mirrors well Ruslan's isolation, which accompanies him in his grief. And please note that this is a baritone voice, not a basso, but he's using the baritone in the lower end of his range, which gives him a bass-like feel. Please, Ruslan's aria, O Love of My Life, a most typical Russian romantic aria.
Oh,